This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
It's very nice to see you all here this evening. A lot of the folks in this room have been deliberating today about the concept of prosperity, right? Very wide-ranging concept that includes lots of goodies. Why shouldn't we just be talking about wealth? Why not just talk about wealth? That's the prerequisite for healthcare and education, all those other wonderful things that we'd like to include. Why not just talk about that?
It is the prerequisite for those things. So that it's certainly true that having more wealth helps everything. So it helps. But it is not the thing itself. So having a lot of wealth is not so great if you're dead, for example. So, you know, you need years to enjoy it. And, you know, life is worth something even if you're quite poor. So that length of life and the benefits that health brings are enormous joy in and of themselves. And without life, wealth is not worth very much. So you could also say, you know, without wealth, life is not very much either. But I think most people would take a life without very much money over no life at all. And wealth certainly makes everything better. So I'm very much in favor of wealth creation. I think it's terrific. But I don't think it's the only thing. And, you know, life is a very important thing. And there are lots of other things that are important. I mean, education also helps make you wealthy. But being educated is a good thing in itself.
Do you worry that economists sometimes focus on wealth to the exclusion of these other important factors?
Yeah, I worry about that a lot. And I think it's a terrible mistake. And I actually think a lot of the inequality debate focuses too much on wealth and too little on these other things, too. Because I actually have no problem with very rich people getting even richer. That seems to me just fine. It doesn't do anything bad to me. But it does bad things to me if they use that wealth instrumentally in ways that hurt me. And, you know, we were talking earlier about crony capitalism. We were talking about, you know, people trying to use extreme wealth to deprive other people's access to the political process. We worried about that a little more than maybe we do now. I don't know. And I think actually I still worry about it. The issue, of course, is it's very difficult to capture the political process, as many people are finding.
Right.
That's right.
So I'm curious about something as a layperson who has only a fleeting familiarity with economics. A lot of your pathbreaking work has been about econometrics, about digging deep into the data.
Yep.
How do you figure out when data is good and reliable? What's the freshness, you know, the viability check for data? How do we figure that out? Because we're so inundated by data today.
Yeah.
Inundated by data.
Yeah.
So how do we sort through it all?
By data.
How do we separate the good data from the bad data? I mean, some of your work seems to address this issue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes it's pretty obvious that people are cheating.
Right. I think China, for some reason, the word China just popped into my head.
I can't imagine why. In China, all public data is a state secret. That actually used to be true in Britain until relatively recently, too. So it's actually not been an uncommon state of affairs. I can only tell you what works for me. And, you know, when I started off my career, I was a research assistant, and I was explaining today that I was sent down into the bowels of the vault of the Institute of Friendly Societies in London. I was a research assistant for a man called Jack Revel, who was constructing the wealth accounts of Britain. And the friendly societies, for some reason, he thought was important. So I was pulling these dusty volumes off the shelf and blowing off the dust and copying down the numbers onto not a spreadsheet, but a sheet that was spread. You know, meaning I had a pencil and a paper and some erasers. And, you know, erasers were a really important tool in those days. When did you last see an eraser? I don't think they even put them on the end of pencils anymore. You know. So I sat there copying down figures for days and days and days and days and then. And, you know, you would have thought that was about the most soul-destroying activity on the planet. But for me, it actually wasn't. Because I found it impossible not to think about these numbers when I copied them down. And so just by thinking about them and copying them down, I would have recognized a really bad one, for instance. If a decimal point had shifted, I would have seen that the decimal point had shifted, or I would have known to investigate it. And, you know, by the time I'd got enough data to play with, I had some hypotheses. I also had some ideas about what would not work, because I knew sort of these data. So I think I developed a very strong smell for what was bad data. You know, like a smell for bad wine or bad cheese or something. You can sort of tell that there's something wrong here. And in fact, for most of the early part of my career, we got data by taking it out of books. I mean, out of dusty volumes and copying it down and processing it that way. And then, you know, drawing it on graph paper. And then the eraser came in very handy, too. And I remember the hours and hours and the endless frustration. You know, you had to throw the graph paper away when you'd erase so many lines that you made a hole in the graph paper. And some of you will remember double logarithmic graph paper where the things got, you know, so you could have a log scale without doing it. So, you know, the kind of part for me today with that is something that I only dreamed about then, which is you can sit in front of a computer terminal and visualize these data for yourself in all sorts of ways. So a lot of what I do is that. And somehow that's how I find out if this makes any sense or it doesn't make any sense. I also like to find sort of paradoxes and puzzles. So I like to find, you know, you look for some data somewhere and you get some other data that ought to be the same and they're not the same. Well, why are they not the same?
Yes.
And sometimes you can track that down, sometimes you can't. So I spend a lot of my life doing that. Much of it is very frustrating. I have many more puzzles than I have answers to puzzles. And so I guess I got a reputation for being sort of honest with my data.
That's fascinating. I think especially with the rise of big data, it's very tempting to lose yourself in the numbers. But what I hear from what you're saying is let's never lose sight of the fact that these data are reflecting something in the real world. And let's go back all the time and
Actually, that's right, but even more than that, I think politics are infused in data from their very creation. And I have this sort of plan for a book, which I may or may not ever write, called The Political Lives of Numbers.
Oh, and please write that.
It's this sort of idea that even right down into the nitty-gritty, the sort of stuff that's out in the weeds that gets into those numbers, the politics is deeply ingrained in there. And so, but that's not a bad thing. I mean, the worst thing is having numbers that no one cares about and no politicians care about, because then they're for sure going to be bad numbers. So politics also puts pressure on numbers, which keeps numbers honest. On the other hand, you can't think of anything like a pure number. You know, the first presidential veto in United States history, you know what that was?
I do not.
It was George Washington, and it was over rounding errors. Would you believe? I mean, it's sort of, you talk about something out in the weeds. And this is because, you know, the Constitution said the number of seats in Congress should be proportional to the population of the state.
Ah, of course.
But of course, that's not a well-defined algorithm, because you can't give 23.4 seats to Massachusetts. So what do you do with the remainders? And Hamilton had a scheme. Of course, Hamilton had a scheme.
Of course.
And he persuaded Congress to pass it, but Jefferson didn't like it. Of course Jefferson didn't like it. So Jefferson persuaded Washington to veto it.
Wow.
And I actually don't think there's more to the story than that, because it would be better if there was some deep political purpose. And I think it wasn't much more than the, you know, long-term rivalry between Jefferson and Hamilton.
Yes.
That caused this to happen. But this idea that the first presidential veto in the United States is over rounding errors.
You fantastic.
Know, it's an interesting story.
That sounds like great material for a Broadway musical.
Yeah. Okay. Popping over the rounded errors.
So I'm curious, do we think that the most important things in life can be measured?
Probably not. We're trying, though. Right? And we're making a much better shot at it than we ever have done before. I mean, all those of us who are working on, you know, the happiness agenda to some extent. I see my friend Carol Graham over there. You know, one of the things we keep discovering is that the time you spend with other people is incredibly important. And so this is an agenda which comes back to the agenda we were talking about before, which is that, you know, economists have certainly focused much too much on the narrow material part of life. And there's a spiritual side to life which is incredibly important, and it comes out, if you look for it in the data, it just comes out and shouts at you. You know, so
you can look for it in the data. How do you find it in the data?
Well, you know, religious people are much more happy with their lives than non-religious people, for example. I used to think it depended, and you know, if you, some of my liberal friends, in fact, this, the Legatum Commission was I was on, we got into this wonderful argument because one of the members of the commission wanted the government, that, you know, we wanted to tabulate the, how, whether doctors were happier than lawyers. you know, and it turns out that publicans, you know, people who work in bars are incredibly unhappy, you know. And so he wanted to publish this list of all, it's what he calls de-shrouding, right?
Ooh.
So every schoolboy and schoolgirl in Britain would know, they say, I want to be a lawyer, and you say, uh-uh, you know, you'll be really, really unhappy if you do that. So I said, okay, I'll vote for that, but you have to publish my table, which shows that religious people are much more happy than non-religious people. And the British government should tell people that, you know, if they go off to church, you know, if you say don't be a lawyer, then you should say don't be irreligious. You should be going to church too. So no. I can't do that at all. So it's sort of interesting. The academics, and this is true in America too, are very, with a few exceptions, religious specialists. Social scientists and economists are very unhappy if you start talking about religion.
Yes, I think that's true. Since we've moved over into a somewhat philosophical realm, I'd like to try a provocative thought. Does improving the quality of people's lives sometimes justify restricting their freedom? You know, there's a very interesting debate about Rwanda in particular, right? Rwanda has this...
I hate Rwanda. Got into terrible trouble.
Excellent.
For Rwanda.
And the argument, of course, is Rwanda gets good results. They do what they say they're going to do. Corruption is not an overt problem. So this very dictatorial regime seems to be, you know, it's providing universal health care, it's doing all of these good things, good outcomes for people. Is that good?
What I said in public, and I got a storm of abuse from this, from the health minister in Rwanda, I said that Kagame was essentially farming out his children to the West.
Oh.
Because of course he says, you know, I'll look after my children if you give me large amounts of aid.
Yeah.
And the aid agencies, of course, are delighted to accept this feisty bargain. And, you know, they'll support him so that he can kill his enemies and put people in jail.
Yeah.
And they look the other way while that's going on because the children are being saved. Now, that's not for me. There are others who will argue that, and it's not a completely crazy argument. You know, so other people make the point of saying, you would have us stop vaccinating the children because you don't like the leadership in this country. And that's a much harder thing to say, yeah, I would have you stop vaccinating the children. But you're making a Faustian bargain here, which is, you're really saying, you know, let us vaccinate the children and let him build his dictatorship at the same time. So actually, I don't really care how people come down on that, but I think they should stop fooling themselves that there aren't awful trade-offs there. And I think even when you're doing things that are much less objectionable than that, like providing antiretroviral drugs that saves people's lives in Africa, which we've done a lot of, and we've saved a lot of lives, and I think that's terrific, you shouldn't be ignoring the long-term unintended consequences of doing those things, which is this government is now strongly disincentivized in providing its own healthcare system. You know, it'll take longer before there's a decent healthcare system in that country. But, you know, if you walk away from it, there's no, you know, I can't pretend that this health service will magically blossom. So these trade-offs are really, really hard. And, you know, I have other things to do than hit people over the head who would make different judgments on that. Yes. But I think people ought to be aware of the trade-off. And the trade-offs are not good.
Well, this is fascinating. I'd love to keep it going all night, I think, but we don't want to overdo it. Let me ask you a question that several people have broached me. I'm sure you get asked this a lot these days. So what was it like to win the Nobel Prize?
You mean the first phone call or the actual, the ceremonies and stuff?
I think the first phone call is funner.
The first phone call was pretty amazing. You know, nowadays, it used to be in the old days that you had no idea, no one really knew when this was going to happen.
Yes.
But now the press makes a big song and dance to it. So you go to bed the night before knowing that the next morning is the day they're going to announce the Nobel Prize. And, you know, I've known for many years that I was a potential possibility. Not that there's anything that ever comes out of Stockholm, but the press have. And actually about 5 years ago, someone at one of the, I think at Thompson's Writer, had named me as their most likely candidate. And I got stormed by the press, you know. And so when I didn't win it, it was sort of a relief, you know. It was sort of like, oh my God, that train just missed me. What it must be like if it were to hit me. Well, you know, it hit me. So, you know, we get up very early in the morning, and it was about 10 after 6, and I got up. You know, I wasn't dressed. I was just, you know, going to clean my teeth and get up. And I saw the clock, and it was 10 after 6, and I thought, so there's another year gone. Not going to happen. And I wasn't ever really expecting it anyway. I mean, my work is very diffuse, and they like to give it for some very, very specific thing. So I thought, you know, I wasn't really, I would not have been surprised had I not won it. But then just as I walked through the bathroom door, the phone started to ring. And my wife Anne was downstairs and she picked up the phone. And I picked it up a second after and I could hear her sort of deep breathing. And then there was a voice, this is a very important telephone call for Professor Deaton from Stockholm. And then I knew, you know, exactly what it was. And it was sort of like, you know, my father used to say to me when I'd done something terrible, he said, "You're from the high jump now, boy." And I thought, "You're for the high jump now." And it, so it was with some apprehension. I mean, this feeling that, like, your life is going to completely change. And it's completely helter-skelter for that moment because they're on the phone for about 15 minutes. They ask you if they're going to, if you will accept it, which I said yes. And I think you got it at that point. You don't actually have to show up and
sign a paper.
Yeah. And then they said, you know, by then it's 25 after 30, half an hour after 6. They say there's a press conference at 7 o'clock. And you can watch it live on television at 7 o'clock, and you'd better be on the phone because the journalists are going to be asking you questions, right? I'm naked at this point. You know? I haven't cleaned my teeth yet, you know, and I think, okay, well, I guess, you know, I could make sure the video isn't on and do this. And then, you know, I wanted to, you know, let my kids know, send text to my kids, and so on. And so we did that, just got there in time for the press conference. And then, of course, for the first of thousands of times, they asked me what I'm going to do about the migrant crisis.
Oh, yes.
Europe, you know, which is, one of the things you discover within seconds is that having a Nobel Prize makes you the world expert on any topic whatsoever. So you get asked these ridiculous questions about, you know, everything and nothing at all. But Princeton was fantastic. Within about 2 minutes after 7, they were showing up at our house and telling us what to do. And they gave...
And they have a lot of experience, which is...
They have a lot of experience. And they gave Anne and I burner phones. You know, like in the noir. And these are phones which no one can trace and which you can use so that you can still reach your kids and your friends and things like this.
That's brilliant.
And then it took me a few hours to realize, how did you know it was going to be me? You know, maybe Stockholm tells Princeton, even if it doesn't tell me. And they said, no, we were preparing for 5 members of your department. Right? So they had, I was one of 5 that they were ready to sprinkle for cash. I was very impressed by that. But it, let me, I've gone on too long, but just a few words about the ceremonies itself.
Yes.
It is like something from another world. I mean, it's like you died and gone to heaven for a week. It's completely magical. They treat you like, they treat you exactly the same as they treat heads of state. So, you know, you're met at the door of the airplane by the president of the National Academy of Sciences and taken down in an elevator to your stretch BMW with your driver who's going to be with you for a week. And there are Nobel Prizes stuck on the outside of the car, so everybody knows who you are. You know, so it's like being the queen. And of course, you never go anywhere near like customs or immigration or things like that, you know. And And that just gives you a taste of how it's going to be all week. And there are concerts and prize givings. And just, it was extraordinary. And you get to take a fair number of guests. So I could take my kids and my grandchildren. Aww. And one of the things I didn't expect at all was it turned into a fabulous family reunion. I mean, my kids are in their 40s. My grandchildren are 9, 8, and 5. And they had the time of their lives. I mean, you should see my 9-year-old in his white tie and tails. They come to the banquet, and he was interviewed during the banquet, and he had like a 15-minute interview on Swedish television. And he was incredibly poised and talked about all the things he'd done in Sweden and what he enjoyed the best. And there were little old ladies I didn't know coming up to me in the street and saying, "Your grandson is the most wonderful thing I've ever seen." For those of you who are grandparents, you'll know that that is better than getting the Nobel Prize. So it was a terrific week, and anyone who gets a chance to do that, go do it. Anyway, thank you for listening.
Thank you so much.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.